The gate is on our right side. Now, for some reason, the gate on the right side had been walled up after the death of the lama and another one opened instead. The monks marveled at this new proof of the authenticity of their lama and all proceeded to his private apartment where tea was to be served. The boy, seated on a pile of large hard cushions, looked at the cup with silver gilt saucer and jeweled cover placed on the table before him. "Give me the larger china cup," he commanded. And he described one, mentioning the very pattern that decorated it. Nobody knew about such a cup, not even the steward, and the monks respectfully endeavored to convince their young master that there was no cup of that kind in the house. It was at that moment that, taking advantage of an already long acquaintance with the nearby, I entered the room. I had heard the snuffbox story and wished to see for myself my remarkable little new neighbor. I offered him the customary complimentary scarf and a few presents. These he received with a gracious smile, but, apparently following the trend of his thoughts regarding the cup, he said, "Look better, you will find it." And suddenly, as if a flash of memory had dashed through his mind, he added explanations about a box painted in such a color, which was in such a place in the storeroom. The monks had briefly informed me of what was going on and I waited with interest to see how things would turn out. Less than half an hour later, the set, cup, saucer and cover, was discovered in a casket that was at the bottom of the very box described by the boy. I did not know of the existence of that cup, the steward told me later on. The lama himself, or my predecessor, must have put it in that box which did not contain anything else precious and had not been opened for years. I also witnessed a much more striking and fantastic discovery of a tulku in the poor inn of a hamlet, some miles distant from Mansi. Roads going from Mongolia to Tibet cross, in that region, the long highway which extends from Peking to Russia over a whole continent. So I felt annoyed but not astonished when, reaching the inn at sunset, I found it crowded with visitors from a Mongolian caravan. The men looked rather excited as if something unusual had just happened. Yet, with their customary courtesy still increased by the sight of the lamaist monastic garments which Lama Yongdan and I wore, the travelers immediately gave up a room for my party and made room for my beasts in the stable. As Yongdan and I remained in the courtyard, looking at the camels of the Mongolians, the door of one of the rooms opened and a tall handsome youth, poorly clad in a Tibetan robe, stood on the threshold and asked if we were Tibetans. We answered in the affirmative. Then a well-dressed elderly lama appeared behind the young man and he, also, addressed us in Tibetan. As usual, we exchanged questions about the country from which we came and where we were going. The lama said that he had intended going to Lhasa by the Sukhaw Winter Road, but now, he added, it was no longer necessary to take this journey. The Mongolian servants who were in the courtyard nodded their assent. I wondered what could have caused these people to change their minds while en route, but as the lama retired to his room, I did not deem it polite to follow and ask explanations that were not offered. However, later in the evening, when they had inquired about Yongdan and me from our servants, the Mongolians invited us to drink tea with them and I heard the whole story. The handsome young man was a native of the far distant Ngari province 106. In southwestern Tibet 106. He seemed to be somewhat of a visionary. At least, most Westerners would have so described him. But we were in Asia. Since his early youth, Mijia, this was his name, had been restless, haunted by the queer idea that he was not where he ought to be. He felt himself a foreigner in his village, a foreigner in his family. In dreams, he saw landscapes that did not exist in Ngari, sandy solitudes, round felt tents, a monastery on a hillock. And even when awake, the same subjective images appeared to him and superimposed themselves on his material surroundings, veiling them, creating around him a perpetual mirage. He was only a boy when he ran away, unable to resist the desire of finding the reality of his vision. Since then, Mijia had been a vagrant, working a little here and there on his way, begging most times, wandering at random without being able to control his restlessness or settle anywhere. Today he had arrived from Marik, tramping aimlessly as usual. He saw the inn, the encampment of the caravan, the camels in the courtyard. Without knowing why, he crossed the gate, and found himself face to face with the Lama and his party. Then, with the rapidity of lightning, past events flashed through his mind. He remembered that very Lama as a young man, his disciple, and himself as an already aged Lama, both on that very road, returning from a pilgrimage to the holy places of Tibet and going home to the monastery on the hillock. He reminded the Lama of all these things, giving minute details regarding their journey, their lives in the distant monastery and many other particulars. Now the aim of the Mongolian's journey was precisely to beg advice from the Dalai Lama as to the best way of discovering the Tulku head of their monastery, whose seat had been unoccupied for more than 20 years, in spite of persevering efforts to find his reincarnation. These superstitious people were ready to believe that the Dalai Lama, through his supernormal power, had detected their intention and out of kindness had caused their meeting with their reincarnated lord. The Ngari wanderer complied immediately with the usual test, picking out without hesitation or mistake among a number of similar objects, those that had belonged to the late Lama. No doubt subsisted in the mind of the Mongolians. On the morrow, I saw the caravan retracing its steps, moving away to the slow pace of the big camels and disappearing on the skyline into the Gobi solitudes. The new Tulku was going to meet his fate. Chapter 4. Dealing with ghosts and demons. The lugubrious communion. A rather large number of Tibetan occultists seem delight in lugubrious musing and practices in which corpses play a prominent part. Vulgar sorcerers only seek by this means to acquire magic powers, but a number of more enlightened men affirm that esoteric teachings and a special kind of spiritual training is thus hidden under the veil of symbols and conventional language. I need not say that this repugnant mysticism has nothing at all in common with Buddhism. It is also foreign to true Lamaism, though a few Lamas secretly yield to its bizarre attraction. Its origin must be sought in the light of Tantric Hinduism and the doctrines of the ancient Bonpo shamanists. The following story will be sufficient to illustrate this dark side of Tibetan occultism. It was told me at Chukwu only a few years after the death of those concerned and by a man who had known them personally. The Lama who plays the principal part was the abbot of Minagpalakhang near to Chai Enlu, known by the name of Chogstsang. He is the author of a number of prophecies regarding events which are to take place in Tibet, China and the world at large. He was regarded as having supernormal powers, among others of being able to cause death. Chogstsang used to behave in a strange, often quite incomprehensible way, and was addicted to drinking. He lived for some time with the Tibetan chieftain of Tachai Enlu who bears the title of Jai Alpo. The king once, while talking and drinking with his host, the Lama asked for the sister of the master of horses his wife. This official, who happened to be present, refused his consent. The Lama was so enraged that he violently threw the precious jade cup in which he had drunk on the ground, breaking it into pieces, and cursed the equerry, declaring that after 2 days he would die. The Jai Alpo did not approve of the Lama's request for his officer's sister and had no faith in the power of his curse. The equerry was young and healthy, he argued. Still the Lama maintained that he would die and, indeed, 2 days later the man passed away. Then the Jai Alpo and the parents of the young maid became frightened and hastened to bring the girl to the Lama. But he refused to take her. She would have been useful, he said, for obtaining an object which would have benefited a large number of beings, but the opportunity has passed, and I do not care for a wife. This story resembles that of Dugpa Kunlegs, mentioned in the first chapter. It is a common theme of Tibetan tales. Now one evening this same Chogstsang unexpectedly called up one of his troopers. "Saddle 2 horses, we are going," he ordered him. The monk remonstrated with the Lama, saying that it was already late and that it would be better to wait the next morning. "Do not answer back," said Chogstsang laconically. "Let us go." They start, ride in the night and arrive at some spot near a river. There they alight from their horses and walk towards the river bank. Though the sky is completely dark, a spot on the water is lighted by sun rays, and in that illuminated place a corpse is floating upstream, moving against the current. After a while it comes within reach of the two men. "Take your knife, cut a piece of the flesh and eat it," commands Chogstsang to his companion. And he adds, "I have a friend in India who sends me a meal every year at this date." Then he himself begins to cut and to eat. The attendant is struck with terror. He endeavors to imitate his master but does not dare to put the morsel into his mouth and hides it in his ambag. 108. The breast pocket formed by the wide Tibetan robe tied with a belt. Both return to the monastery where they arrive at dawn. The Lama says to the monk, "I wished you to share the favor and the most excellent fruits of this mystic meal, but you are not worthy of it. That is why you have not dared to eat the piece which you have cut off and hidden under your dress." Hearing these words, the monk repents of his lack of courage and puts his hand into his ambag to take his share of the corpse, but the piece of flesh is no longer there. This fantastic story accords with certain information given me with great reserve by some anchorites belonging to the Dzogchen sect. There exist, so they said, certain human beings who have attained such a high degree of spiritual perfection, that the original material substance of their bodies has become transmuted into a more subtle one which possesses special qualities. Few people can discern the change which has come over these exceptional men. A morsel of their transformed flesh, when eaten, will produce a special kind of ecstasy and bestow knowledge and supernormal powers upon the person partaking of it. A hermit told me that when an Aljorpa, through his clairvoyance, has discovered one of these wonderful beings, he sometimes begs from him the favor of being informed of his death in order that he may obtain a small portion of his precious body. Might fervent candidates for this gruesome communion not sometimes grow too impatient and refuse to wait for the natural death of the Holy One? Might they not hurry it forward? One of those who disclosed this secret rite to me, almost seemed to confess that the thing had happened. However, he was careful to mention the attenuating circumstance that the victim consented to the sacrifice. The corpse who dances another mysterious rite is called rolling. 109. The corpse who stands up. 109. Traditions and ancient chronicles relate that, before the introduction of Buddhism into Tibet, it was practiced by the Bonpo shamans during the funeral ceremony. However, the brief movement made by a dead body in such circumstances cannot be compared with what happens in the course of the horrible and grotesque tete-a-tete that Tibetan occultists depict. End of this part.